حديث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على خير خلق الله العبد المؤيد والرسول المسدد حبيب إله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين وصحابته المنتجبين، صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله، صلى الله عليك يا سيدي ويا مولاي يا ابن رسول الله، يا رحمة الله الواسعة ويا باب نجاة الأمة ويا عبرة كل مؤمن ومؤمنة يا ليتنا كنا معكم سادتي فنفوز فوزا عظيما. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولا تقف ما ليس لك به علم، إن السمع والبصر والفؤاد كل أولئك كان عنه مسؤولا. عطروا أفواهكم بذكر الصلاة على محمد وآل محمد. A second for the love of Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Hussein. A third salawat for the love of Fatima al-Zahra with your loudest voices. A wise man once said that people usually give opinions to their specialized fields. Usually, when you're having a discussion with a group of people, if you're an engineer, you tend to give an opinion in your field, in the field of engineering. If you're a lawyer, you tend to give legal advice, opinion in that specific field. If you're a pilot, you give an opinion in your field. Except two fields. There's two fields in which everyone gives his opinions, according to this wise man. The first field is medicine. In a room full of 10 or 20 people, say that you have a sore throat. You'll get 20 opinions. One says, bring tea, put lemon in it, make sure it's hot. Another person says, eat soup. Another person says, take cough drops, and so on and so forth. They all become doctors all of a sudden. This is one field. And the second field is the field of religion. In religion, everyone has an opinion. You pose one question and all of a sudden everyone becomes marja' al-taqlid. You say, for example, what's your opinion of beating your chest during Muharram for Imam Hussein? And you hear all kinds of answers. One says, it's absolutely haram, it's forbidden. Another says, it's wajib. Another says, it's recommended. Another one says, it's discouraged. And you have various answers. And this is a problem. This is a problem. When people don't have religious knowledge, this is not their area of specialty. Their knowledge is very limited. And then they stand and issue fatwas. They stand and give religious opinions. This is a problem. This is worse than giving a medical opinion. Why? Because your medical advice will not lead to heaven and hell. But when you give religious advice, it could lead to hell. You might bring people to hell, not only yourself, but others as well, if you give the wrong advice, if you give the wrong opinion. However, there's lots of people that give their religious opinions without knowledge. And this is a problem. In some parts of America, because there's not too many scholars, I know some parts of America, cab drivers are made into imams of Islamic centers. Because there's no other imam, there's no one else to come lead prayer. I know several imams, they're cab drivers. They haven't studied, they haven't memorized, they haven't been to a traditional Islamic seminary, not in Iraq, not in Iran, not in Saudi Arabia, nowhere. And he comes and leads Muslims in prayers, gives lectures, gives his opinions. In fact, sometimes he's invited to come on the media. He's invited to come speak about Islam. They pose questions, and he has to answer. And come and see some of them. What do they do to Islam? What do they do to the image of Islam? The ridiculous answers that they give. The embarrassing answers that they give. And most of them, they don't even speak English either. I remember one, I saw him, and this was extremely embarrassing. It was ridiculous, it was funny, but it was embarrassing at the same time. The commentator asked him, what do you do for a living? One of these cab drivers that became an imam. He said, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a Muslim breast. He said, Muslim what? He said, Muslim breast. He said, you mean Muslim priest? He said, yeah, that's what I said, Muslim breast. And this person is representing Islam on CNN. And the world is watching to see what Islam has to say over a topic, over a subject. A cab driver is representing Islam. This is a problem. Sometimes we get more sophisticated than that. Sometimes we have doctors and physicians, maybe lawyers, maybe engineers speaking about Islam. Some give lectures. And that, there's nothing wrong with that. As long as you stick to the guidelines, there's nothing wrong with that. But unfortunately, some, because he sees himself as a doctor, he's a physician, he's a lawyer, that immediately gives him the right to give his own personal interpretation of Islam. His own personal interpretation of the Quran or the Sunnah of Rasulullah. This is a problem. When you begin to give your personal interpretation, when you give your personal fatwa in Islam, this is a problem. Because you're not qualified. I remember once listening to one of these intellectual lecturers, and he was speaking about how heaven and hell are only mental. They don't exist in real life. Meaning in the next life, heaven and hell are all purely mental. It's only a mental state of being. There's no such thing as a real place called heaven. There's no such thing as a real place called hell. And I don't know where he bought this from. The Quran describes heaven in so many places, describes hell in so many places. How can you actually say that heaven and hell are a mental state of being? They don't actually exist. No, they actually exist. The Quran speaks of the rivers, the palaces, the fruits, the meat, the all kinds of pleasures that exist in heaven, and the all kind of punishments that exist in hell. Another one would say, and I heard this, that, oh people, you don't need to give khums to the maraja. Why? Because the tax that you give to the government, this is considered khums. Where'd you bring this from? Where'd you bring this from? This is what happens when we abandon the traditional teachings. This is what happens. We begin to give our personal interpretation. And every year we have an issue over heading the heads with swords, which is called tatbir. There are some that say it is absolutely forbidden. It's haram. And others make it wajib. What is this? Is this a game? You make whatever you want wajib and you make whatever you want haram? Besides the issue, let's not be emotional. You see, when deriving Islamic laws, you have to put emotions aside. You cannot bring your emotions into deriving the laws. No, you have to be objective. You have to be purely objective. Thus, you can't make it wajib because you feel like it. You cannot make it haram because you feel like it. You look to the proof. You look to the sources. The famous saying says, "نَحْنُ أَبْنَاءُ الدَّلِيلِ حَيْثُمَا مَالَ نَمِيلِ." We look to the proof. We look to the sources. We see what the sources say. That is why when we look at Islamic teachings, we see that Islam has taken a strong stand against those that speak without knowledge. Those that give their personal interpretation without knowledge. Or based on personal taste. He explains the Quran. He interprets the Quran according to his personal taste. According to his personal logic. He calls a certain narration uncredible, unauthentic. Why? Because it doesn't fit his personal taste. He issues his own fatwas because it fits his personal logic, his personal taste. This is forbidden. The Quran says, وَلَا تَقْفُ مَا لَيْسَ لَكَ بِهِ عِلْمٌ إِنَّ السَّمْعَ وَالْبَصَرَ وَالْفُؤَادَ كُلُّ أُولَٰئِكَ كَانَ عَنْهُ مَسْؤُولًا. Don't speak without knowledge. If there is an area in which you don't have knowledge in, don't speak. Don't pass your judgment. Don't give your personal interpretation. This will cause chaos. Because everyone will give his own interpretation. Everyone will give his own personal thought. إِنَّ دِينَ اللَّهِ لَا يُقَاسُ بِالْعُقُولِ. You cannot explain the Qur'an and the Sunnah of Rasulullah because your mind says so. No. Because your logic says so. دِينَ اللَّهِ لَا يُقَاسُ بِالْعُقُولِ. Our minds are limited. Our knowledge is limited. Even our logic is limited. I'll give you an example. 100 years ago, they used to say that the smallest living particle was what? Was what? The atom. Today, the smallest living particle is what? The cell. 100 years ago, no one knew this. They took it as a fact that the atom is the smallest living particle. Today it's a fact that the cell is the smallest living particle. Or the smallest living entity. Maybe in 100 years, this fact will also change. These scientific facts that we take as facts, later on they might change. Thus, إِنَّ دِينَ اللَّهِ لَا يُقَاسُ بِالْعُقُولِ. In another hadith, مَنْ أَفْتَى بِغَيْرِ عَلْمٍ وَلَا هُدًى مِّنَ اللَّهِ لَعَنَتْهُ مَلَائِكَةُ الرَّحْمَةُ وَمَلَائِكَةُ الْعَذَابُ. That he who gives a fatwa not based on knowledge and not based on guidance from Allah, this person is cursed. The angels of wrath will punish him, will curse him, and the angels of mercy will also curse him. When we read Islamic history, we see that some of the biggest tragedies occurred because some people spoke without knowledge. Some people gave their own opinion without knowledge. This created chaos. This created a tragedy. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullahi alayh, in the battle of Saffin against Muawiyah, he was about to win this battle. When Muawiyah realized that he was about to lose to Imam Ali, he asked his advisor, Amr ibn al-As. He said, "Do you have any suggestions? We're about to lose the battle." Amr said, "Yes, I have a suggestion. Order your soldiers to take copies of the Quran, stick them on their spears, and lift them up." He said, "Why?" He said, "Just do it, and you'll see what happens." The soldiers of Muawiyah took copies of the Quran, they stuck them in their spears, and they lifted the spears, lifted the copies of the Quran. As soon as the soldiers of Imam Ali, they saw this, they stopped fighting. Why? Meaning that let the Quran act as an arbitrator. Let the Quran decide who's right and who's wrong. Imam Ali told him, this is a trick. Don't fall into this trick. This is a trick from Muawiyah. His soldiers said, no, we will not fight. In fact, not only will we not fight, we will force you to stop fighting. They made him stop Malik al-Ashtar. Malik al-Ashtar was about to defeat Muawiyah. They told him, call Malik al-Ashtar and told him to stop. Tell him to stop. Amir al-Mu'mineen was forced to stop. Then, both groups, Muawiyah's side and Imam Ali's soldiers, without the approval of Imam Ali, decided to have an arbitration called Tahkim. They decided to choose one person from each side, get together, and choose who should be the rightful Khalifa, Muawiyah or Imam Ali. As for Muawiyah's side, they chose Amr ibn al-As. Imam Ali's soldiers, they chose a man by the name of Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. Abu Musa al-Ash'ari, to be polite, was an idiot. Imam Ali told them, do not choose Abu Musa. Abu Musa is not the right person for the job. His soldiers insisted that it has to be Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. Imam Ali said, this person will do us injustice. They said, no. We insist that it has to be Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. Abu Musa and Amr ibn al-As decided to meet. Before they went into the meeting, some of the loyal companions of Imam Ali told Abu Musa that when you go to the meeting, whatever it is that you decide, when you come out and decide to speak, something like a press conference, when you decide to give the result of this meeting, have Amr ibn al-As speak first. You don't speak first. Okay? He said, okay. They went into the gathering. Abu Musa told Amr, he said, what's your suggestion? What should we do to fix this problem between Imam Ali and Muawiyah? Amr said, my suggestion is that we remove both of them. We remove both of them and we choose a Khalifa from the people. We let the people decide who's the Khalifa. What do you think? Abu Musa says, this is a good idea. Amr says to Abu Musa, he said, I suggest that when we leave this meeting, you speak first. Abu Musa, you speak first and you tell the people that I remove Imam Ali from the Khilafah the same way I remove my ring from my finger. And I will speak after you and do the same. I will say I remove Muawiyah from the Khilafah the same way I remove my ring from my finger. Okay? Okay. They leave. The meeting ends. Who speaks first? Abu Musa. Abu Musa comes in front of all the Muslims and he says, oh people, I have removed Ali ibn Abi Talib from the Khilafah the same way I remove my ring from my finger. He says, my job is done. Amr ibn al-As comes. He says, oh people, I install Muawiyah to become the Khalifa the same way I wear my ring on my finger. That's it. An idiot like Abu Musa al-Ash'ari destroys the entire history. And he creates a major conflict among the Muslims. Why? Because he spoke without knowledge. He spoke out of ignorance. And he brought an entire conflict among Muslims. And then there was another battle called the Battle of Jamal. A group of people from the soldiers of Imam Ali called the Khawarij. They revolted against the Imam and so many people died. So much blood was shed because of one ignorant person who spoke out of ignorance, not out of knowledge. Thus, when we read history, we see that lots of tragedies occurred because a group of people, they spoke out of ignorance, without knowledge. Abandoning, because they abandoned the true source of knowledge. Another man who performed this رحم الله من ذكر القائمة من آل محمد. Please stand, brothers. Please stand and pull forward, please, as much as possible. Sisters, push back. I know it's very difficult, but push back. Come forward, please. If you can come on the stage, come on stage. Come forward. Make room, please. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Abu Hanifa is a very well-known scholar. Abu Hanifa instituted his own school of thought called the Hanafi school of thought. Even though Abu Hanifa studied under Imam al-Sadiq for 2 years, and that's why he has a famous saying, لَوْلَ سَنَتَانْ لَهَلَكَ النُّعْمَانِ. If it wasn't for the 2 years, Al-Nu'man, his first name was Al-Nu'man, Al-Nu'man would have perished. Abu Hanifa, as they say, he only considered 17 narrations from the Prophet to be authentic. There's thousands of narrations, but according to Abu Hanifa, only 17 narrations are authentic. All the other narrations are unauthentic. Okay. We believe that Islam is a way of life. Islam has laws pertaining to the entire life. Every single aspect of life, there's an Islamic law. Well, how many laws can you derive from 17 narrations? Not too many laws. That's why Abu Hanifa developed a concept called what? Qiyas. Qiyas meaning analogy. What's Qiyas? Qiyas means, according to Abu Hanifa, that there's a specific law, for example. There's another case similar to this case. There's case A. We know the law of case A. There's case B similar to case A. Thinking that the same cause that's in case A is in case B. That's why he brings the same law pertaining to case A to case B. Let me give you an example. This might seem abstract. I'll give you an example. Urine is one of the impure things considered impure in Islam. In prayer, if a drop of urine comes out, your prayer is what? Batil. It's invalid. Well, how about a drop of blood? If, for example, in the middle of prayer, your hand gets cut and a drop of blood comes out, does that invalidate your prayer? Abu Hanifa says that bone, urine is najis. And blood is also what? Najis. If bone, urine comes out during prayer, it invalidates your prayer. So since blood is also najis, if blood comes out from your body during prayer, it's what? It's batil as well. This is called qiyas. This is called analogy. Taking a law from one case and bringing it to another case. This is batil. This is not accepted. That is why Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, one time he meets with Abu Hanifa. He says, "Ya Abu Hanifa, I've heard that you use analogies when you derive Islamic laws. Is this true?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Be careful. The first person that used an analogy was whom? Iblis. أول من قاس هو إبليس. How? قال أنا خير من خلقتني من نار وخلقته من طين. Iblis told Allah that I'm better. Why? Because I was created from fire and you created Adam from dirt. And fire is better than dirt. إياك والقياس. And then Imam Sadiq tests him. He says, if you want to use qiyas, if you want to use analogy, well, let's test your qiyas. Which is more important, prayer or fasting? Which is more important? Prayer. Rasulullah, what did he say? As-sawmu amududdin, or he said as-salatu amududdin? As-salatu amududdin. Prayer is the foundation of faith, not fasting. Okay. Women, during their menstrual cycle, they don't pray and they don't fast. But afterwards, they have to make up what? Fasting. How about prayer? No. Even though prayer is more important than fasting, but they make up fasting and not prayer. This shows you that qiyas is batil. Which is worse, killing, murder, or adultery? Murder, absolutely. Murder is worse than adultery. However, in an Islamic court, you need 4 witnesses to prove adultery. And you need how many witnesses to prove murder? Only 2. Isn't this qiyas? Well, if your qiyas worked, Why didn't it work here? This proves that qiyas is batil. Abu Hanifa established an entire fiqh, an entire school of thought based on qiyas. Why? Because he spoke out of ignorance. He didn't speak out of knowledge. If he had stuck to the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt, none of this would have happened. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The problem is when intellectuals give their personal interpretation of faith. This is a problem. Especially if he has a DR in front of his name and he comes and he speaks. Again, I said, if he speaks according to the guidelines, there's nothing wrong with it. But as soon as he begins to give his personal interpretation, his personal fatwas, this is a problem. Especially if he considers himself an intellectual. Especially if he's a doctor or a physician. Why? Because people, they think he's an expert. When people hear of Dr. Fulan, Dr. X or Dr. Y, they immediately begin to accept whatever he says as an authority. Stanley Milgram, a famous psychologist, American psychologist, he says that people psychologically, they have a tendency to accept a saying from someone who's an authority or claims to be an authority. So for example, if there's two people, Mr. X and Mr. Y, they say the same exact statement. But if Mr. X is Dr. X and Mr. Y is just Mr. Y, they have a tendency to accept what Dr. X has to say. Why? Because he's a doctor. Even though it's not in his own field. He's a physician, he's a doctor. But as long as he has a doctor in front of his name, whatever he says, he's an authority. He's an expert. And this is a problem. People begin to accept what others have to say. They think he's an authority. They think he's an expert. And they accept everything that he says. Well, let me ask you a question. If I were to go into a hospital dressed like this, I go in front of the patients and other doctors, and I say, well, don't give that patient that medicine. Don't. And this medicine, put him into surgery. And this patient has to undergo bypass surgery right now. Would anyone listen? Absolutely not, because I'm not a doctor. I'm not a physician. My field is religion. My field is not medicine. My field is not biology. So how come there's a double standard? How come I don't have the right to pass medical opinions, but a doctor has the right to pass religious opinions? Why is that? Why is there a double standard? This is an issue. This is a problem. Not just in medicine, but even in, alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah, even in physics, even in engineering, even in law. I can't give my opinion because I'm not an expert in that field. You have to refer to the experts. That's why, my dear friends, in an Islamic seminary, scholars spend decades. In religion, we have to refer to scholars. Religious scholars, those who spend decades at an Islamic seminary. What do you think they're doing for decades? Playing games? Playing chess? They're researching. They're studying. Number one, they master the Arabic language. This is number one. Number two, they study logic, philosophy, eloquence, grammar. They study fiqh, Islamic law. They study the introduction to fiqh or principles of jurisprudence, usul al-fiqh. They have to master these sciences. They have to study the Quran, master the Quran and the Quranic language. Master the narrations of Rasulullah and his family. This takes decades. Only in Bahth al-Kharij, some religious students study for over 10 years. 10 years is not a joke. A minimum of 10 years only in Bahth al-Kharij. Some study for over 15 years. Why? Only to get the ability to have the ability to derive Islamic laws. This is not a joke. And then all of a sudden you have some intellectual. He stands and he gives his personal interpretation and he knocks out the 20 or 25 years that jurists spend at an Islamic seminary. You think this is a joke? Salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I'll give you one example of how our jurists derive Islamic laws. Just one example. To show you how complicated it is. How complicated it is. And how much research it requires. There's one mas'ala, one question, over the purity of people, the people of the book. Meaning Christians and Jews. Are they pure or are they not pure? Are they tahir or are they najis? If you ask some intellectual speakers, they'll tell you this is nonsense. Of course they're pure. Of course the people of the book are pure. Christians and Jews, they're tahir. We tell them, hold on a second, slow down. Slow down. Come and see what our scholars have said. Our scholars spend months in researching this issue. Months. They research thus just one question. Are the people of the book, Christians and Jews, are they tahir or not? As-Sayyid al-Khoi, rahimahullah, in Al-Tanqih, fi Sharh al-Urwa, spends over 30 pages just discussing this issue. And finally, after discussing this issue in 30 pages, he finally says, there's ihtiyat luzumi. Ihtiyat luzumi. He doesn't give a direct answer. A jurist like Sayyid al-Khoi, who spent over 9 years, 90 years in the Islamic seminary, he doesn't give a direct answer. And then you have others that say, no, they're tahir. We live in a Western society. How can you say that they're najis? How can you say they're impure? What's the proof? First of all, we have to look at the Quran. Does the Quran say anything about the people of the book? Some say yes. There's a verse that says, إِنَّمَا الْمُشْرِكُونَ نَجَسْ. Let's take it. Does this verse say that the people of the book, meaning Christians and Jews, they're impure? First of all, let's look at the verse. The verse says, إِنَّمَا الْمُشْرِكُونَ. What's a mushrik? A pagan. A pagan. Not the people of the book. The people of the book are not pagans. This is number one. Number two, the verse says najas. Innamal mushrikuna najas. Najas is one thing, najis is another. Najas means physically impure. Najas means spiritually impure. There's a difference. Thus, you cannot take this verse. And you can only understand this verse if you understand the Arabic language, if you master the Arabic language. If there's no verses, we go to the second source of Islamic law. That's the narrations. When we come to the narrations, we see a group of narrations, over 20 narrations, stating that the people of the book are najis. And at the same time, we have another group of 20 or more narrations stating that the people of the book are not najis. What do? You have two groups of narrations. Not one narration versus another narration. Two groups of narrations conflicting. Some say the people of the book are najis, and the other group says they're not najis. What do? First, you have to refer to Ilm al-Rajal. First, you have to refer to the chain of narrators to see which ahadith are authentic and which are not authentic. This means you have to master the chain of narrators, Ilm al-Rajal. And this science takes years. Takes years to study Al-Marajah. However, since we have too many narrations, that's why we don't necessarily need to look at the chain of narrators. Because if it was one or two, we have to make sure if this narration is authentic or not. But as long as there are 20 narrations, we have certainty that at least one of them is authentic. And on the other side, we have certainty that at least one of them is authentic. I might have lost some of my audience, but bear with me. This is important. I'm trying to prove a point here. I'm trying to show that how much efforts the jurists have to make to come up with one issue. Taharat Ahlul Kitab. Since We have two groups, and we cannot decide upon from the train of narrators. We go to a concept in Usul al-Fiqh called Ta'adul and Tarajih. We have to choose one side. Which side? The narrations that say the people of the book are pure, or the group of narrations that say they're impure. In the concept of Ta'adul and Tarajih, there's two other concepts. In Ta'adul and Tarajih, they say that if there's two conflicting groups of narrations, and this happens a lot. For example, in alcohol, wine, is wine pure or impure? We have conflicting narrations. Some narrations say it's pure, other narrations say it's impure. Which one do we choose? In Ta'adul and Tarajih, our scholars tell us which to choose. ما وافق كتاب الله أو ما خالف العام. The ahadith that conform to the Quran, we choose that side. Or the ahadith that conflict with the am, with our Sunni brothers and sisters. And I'll mention why. When we come to these groups, they both conform to the Quran. We don't have one group conforming to the Quran more than the other, so we can't choose this. Which group of ahadith conflict with our Sunni brothers and sisters? Neither. Why do we say choose the group of ahadith that conflict with the Ammah? Why? Because we're stubborn? Because whatever they choose, we have to go against? No. Some people think that we are stubborn with our Sunni brothers and sisters. Whatever they choose, we have to choose the opposite. No, that's not the case. It's because our imams, sometimes they had to use taqiyya in their narrations. Sometimes they're asked a question and they could not be direct. They cannot be direct. They have to conform in their narration with what the government would say. That's why if we see a narration that conforms with what our Sunni brothers and sisters say, we say that this hadith was stated out of taqiyya. That's why we neglect it. I know this is extremely confusing. At the end of the day, some jurists could not choose which group. The group that says people of the book are pure, or the group that says they're not pure. That's why a faqih, like a Sayyid al-Khoi says, احتياط لزومي. That if you shake the hands of a Christian or a Jew, as a precaution, go and wash your hands. If your hand was moist or his hand was moist. As a precaution. Thus, this proves a point, my dear friends, that we can't come and pass a judgment, pass a personal opinion without knowledge. We need to refer to our jurists, the jurists who spend lots of years at an Islamic seminary, mastering the Arabic language, mastering the books of fiqh, mastering the books of ahadith, mastering the Quran, mastering ilm al-usul, mastering ilm al-rajal. It's not simple. That's just because a person claims to be an authority, claims to be an expert. We can't listen to him. I listened to one of these intellectual speakers. He would say that today, since we don't need polygamy, since men today, they don't need to marry more than one wife, and I know that this is a very sensitive issue, since men don't need to marry more than one wife, we should make it haram. We should make the issue of marrying more than one wife, we should make this haram. The sisters say, yes, we agree with this. This is nonsense. Just because we don't need something, we make it haram? This is ridiculous. Just because something is not needed, and this is the first question, who said it's not needed? And let's say it's not needed. Let's say we agree and we say it's not needed. We make it haram? Everything that's not needed, we have to cut it out? Well, we all have two kidneys. How many kidneys do you need? Just one. Does it mean that you have to get a surgery and take the other kidney out? That's ridiculous. Some biologists say that the smallest toe on your foot in a couple of years, according to scholars of evolution, they say that in a couple of years, the smallest toe on your foot, it will probably dissolve. Because it's useless. We don't need it. Does that mean that we could go and cut it off? You don't need it, just cut it off. This is not the right logic. This is not objective logic. This is not how you discuss religious topics. Another one would say that previously during the month of Ramadan, you would break your fast while traveling because traveling was difficult. And since fasting during traveling is extremely difficult, Islam says break your fast. But today there's planes, there's trains. Traveling is not difficult. Fasting is not difficult while traveling, so you can fast while you're traveling. This is nonsense. The Quran says, فَمَنْ كَانَ مِنْكُمْ مَرِيضًا أَوْ عَلَى سَفَرٍ فَعِدَّةٌ مِنْ أَيَّامٍ أُخَرٍ. This is violating Islamic laws, the Quranic law. I heard another speaker saying that why do we have a problem every year with the moon sighting? Let's fix the problem. Let's say that we decide on when is the moon born by the telescope or by scientific calculations. By scientific calculations. We say, you know what, this is a nice theory. It sounds good. But Islam opposes it. Rasulullah opposes it. Rasulullah did not say, start fasting and end your fast according to scientific calculations. The Quran, Rasulullah says, begin fasting and end your fasting with what? By sighting. Sum lil-ru'ya, waftar lil-ru'ya. Thus, let's stick to our scholars, my dear friends. Let's not go right, let's not go left. Let's stick to our scholars who have spent decades in Islamic seminaries, and let's receive Islamic laws from them. And this is a very important issue, my dear friends, the issue of taqleed. Some people say, we don't need to do taqleed. Everything is clear for me. I don't need to follow a scholar. Why do I need to follow a scholar that's sitting in Najaf or Karbala or Qom? I know everything and I don't need to follow a scholar. This is not right. You might know the basics, but not the details. But not the details. When you go to Hajj, and when you're going from Medina to Mecca, do you ride a bus that has a cover or doesn't have a cover? What's the answer? You don't know. You have to refer to the jurist. You have to refer to the faqih that tells you what to do. You can't pick and choose. You can't choose what's easy. Oh, and this is another issue. Some youth, I know some youth that actually do taqleed, they said, we follow the easiest. We see whichever jurist is the easiest, we follow the easiest scholar. So if one scholar says that it's okay to listen to music, we'll follow that scholar. If one scholar says it's okay to smoke, we'll follow that scholar. Is it about following the easiest? Is this what it's about? Following the easiest jurist? And I hear this from youth all the time, that we should follow the easiest. I follow the easiest scholar. Let me ask you a question. If you're diagnosed with an illness, if you have heart disease, and you go to the hospital, and there's two doctors, and you have heart disease, one doctor says you have to undergo bypass surgery, you have to have surgery. The other doctor says just take aspirin and you'll be fine. Which one do you follow? The one that says aspirin and that's it, you feel okay? Just because he's the easiest? Absolutely not. This is a life or death situation. It's not about the easiest. It's about the most knowledgeable. It's about who you can trust the most. It's about who you can trust with your life. How come when it comes to medicine, we follow the most knowledgeable doctor, but when it comes to faith, when it comes to religion, we follow the easiest? Isn't this a matter of heaven and hell? Isn't this a matter of faith and religion? How come in the case of medicine, we follow the most knowledgeable? When it comes to the issue of religion, we follow the easiest. This is wrong. We have to follow the most knowledgeable. And we have to ask about who is the most knowledgeable. And of course, this is a whole case by itself. Who is the most knowledgeable? They say you must refer to Ahl al-Khibra. Who are Ahl al-Khibra? Those who live in the Islamic seminaries, that study at Islamic seminaries and have the ability to discern who's the most knowledgeable scholar. This scholar is more knowledgeable than the other scholar. This is a must. This is a matter of faith, my dear friends. Tomorrow we'll be asked, وَقِفُوهُمْ إِنَّهُمْ مَسْؤُولُونَ. This is not a joke. This is religion. This is a religion that will take us to heaven. Let's not have shortcomings with our faith. Tomorrow we'll be asked, يَوْمَ نَدْعُوا كُلُّ أُنَاسٍ بِإِمَامِهِمْ. Tomorrow they will ask us, who did you follow? And why did you follow him? For what reasons? Because he allowed you to do this or to do that? Because he allowed you to listen to this or smoke that or other things? This is wrong. Tomorrow we'll be asked. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Tonight is a special night, my dear friends. Tonight is the eve of the 7th of Muharram. Traditionally, this night is given to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, salam Allah alayhi, Qamar al-Ashira, Bab al-Hawa'ij, this great champion, this great scholar, this loyal brother that was born to be with Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Ashura. This was the reason why he was born. Did you know this? Amir al-Mu'mineen salam Allahi alayhi, after the death of Fatima al-Zahra, he told his brother Aqil, find me a wife. Aqil told him, which kind of wife? What qualities? He said, uridu imra'atan waladatha al-fuhulatu min al-arab. I want a woman that's courageous, that comes from a courageous family. And this is strange. Usually, men don't ask about courage in a woman. Men don't look in a woman for courage. They look for beauty, they look for other things, but not courage. Usually, courage is a good quality in men, not women. People want men to be courageous. Women are not required of them to be courageous. So Aqil asks Amir al-Mu'mineen, he says, why? Why a courageous woman? He says, لأرزق منها ولدا أدخره ليوم الشدة. So that Allah may grant me a son from this woman, and this son will be an investment for me for a difficult day, the day of Ashura. And indeed, when Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas was born, Amir al-Mu'mineen receives him, he kisses him, he embraces him, he says the adhan in his right ear and the iqam in his left ear. And Al-Abbas from day one was an incredibly beautiful child. That's why they called him Qamar al-Ashira, the moon of his tribe, the moon of his family. Qamar bani Hashim, the moon of the family of Hashim. Umm al-Baneen noticed that Amir al-Mu'mineen would look at the two hands of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas and his tears would come down on his cheeks. She would say, why, ya Amir al-Mu'mineen? Is there something wrong with my son? Is there a defect? Is there a disability in my son? He said, no, there's no disability. But I cry for these two palms, for these two hands, because in the future they will be cut. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas is a great person, a great champion. Bab al-Hawa'ij. If you have something in your heart, if you want something dearly, go to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. I guarantee it. Whatever you want, whatever you have in your heart, Allah will give you. Just beseech him for the sake of Abu al-Fadl. For the sake of al-Abbas, and you will receive whatever you want. You want to know the value of al-Abbas? Imam Hussein tells us the value. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he speaks to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, and he tells him, اركب بنفسي أنت يا أخي. Go on top of your horse. May your brother, meaning whom? The Imam himself. May your brother be a sacrifice for you, ya Abu al-Fadl. The Imam Hussein alayhi salam is willing to sacrifice himself for his brother al-Abbas. An Imam, an infallible person, is willing to sacrifice himself for al-Abbas. Finally, on the day of Ashura, when all the companions had left, not a single companion remaining, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas comes to the Imam and he says, my dear Imam, Ya ibn Rasulullah, give me permission to enter the battlefield. Imam Hussein looks right, looks to his right, looks to his left, and he notices none of the men are remaining. He says, أخي يا أبا الفضل أنت صاحب لوائي فإذا مضيت تفرق عسكري. My dear brother, you're the only man remaining in my camp. You're the only man remaining in my army. If you go, I don't have an army anymore. You're the standard bearer, يا أبا الفضل. أبا الفضل Abbas tells his brother that, my dear brother, I have no more patience. The sound of the cries and the shouts of the children screaming, Al-Atash, Al-Atash, is killing me, my brother. I can no longer witness the children screaming from thirst. Allow me to go and seek my vengeance from these enemies. Imam Hussein alayhi salam finally tells him, Irkab binafsi anta ya akhi. Ride your horse and go to the enemy. May your brother be a sacrifice for you. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas enters the Mashra'ah. He comes close to the river. As soon as the enemies, they saw him, they went away. They went away. They left the river unprotected. As soon as they saw Abu al-Fadl, they remembered the courage of his father, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas comes down. He mounts his horse. He comes to the river. He grabs a handful of water. He brings it to his mouth. All of a sudden, he hears shouts of the children, Al-Atash, Al-Atash. He immediately lets the water drop. And he says, Ya nafsu min ba'd al-Husayn huni. Wa ba'dahu la kunti antakuni. Wa tashrabina barid al-ma'ini. Tallah ma hadha fi'alu dini. He speaks to his soul. He says, oh soul, you don't exist after Imam Hussein. Your only existence is for the existence of Imam Hussein. He drops the water. He fills the water container. He gets up out on top of his horse. He's about to come back to the camp. The enemy soldiers surround him from every direction. He fights. He still has the sword in his right hand. He fights fiercely. All of a sudden, Warqat ibn Nawfal was hiding behind a tree. He comes from behind him and he hits him with a sword on his right hand. He cuts off his right hand. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas begins to say, Wallahi in qata'tumu yamini. Inni uhami abadan an dini. Wa an imamin sadiq al-yaqini. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas grabs his sword in his left hand. He fights until Al-Hakim ibn al-Tufayl also hits him on his left hand. He cuts off his left hand. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas grabs the container with his teeth. He still had hope till that second. Al-Abbas had hope in bringing the water to the children of Imam Hussein. But you know when Al-Abbas lost hope? The second he lost hope was when an arrow hit the container. The container falls to the ground and the water pours. At that second, Al-Abbas lost hope. He didn't wish to go back. Standing there without his arm, without his hands, waiting on his horse, all of a sudden an arrow comes and pierces his eye. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas has an arrow in his eye. When something goes in your eye, what do you usually do? What's the first thing that you do when something goes in your eye? Immediately your hands rush to your eye to remove whatever it is. But Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas has no hands. He can't remove what it is. All of a sudden, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas feels something on his head. One of the enemy soldiers grabs a metal pole and hits al-Abbas on his head. He falls to the ground. For the first time in his life, Al-Abbas says, Ya akhi adrak akhak. My brother, his entire life, he would address Imam Hussein as Yabna Rasulullah. O son of Rasulullah. But today, the only day, his last day, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas says, my brother, come to the rescue of your brother. Imam Hussein hears the sound of Al-Abbas. He rides his horse. He comes, as he comes close to the river, Imam Hussein comes down. He approaches, he sees a body from far away. He approaches, all of a sudden he sees a container on the ground. As he walks, he sees a flag is also dropped on the ground. And then he sees there's two palms, there's two hands on the ground. Imam Hussein collects these palms, he kisses these palms, and he holds closely to them. خويا خويا قل العلم وين اوديه خويا قل العلم وين ودي نور العين دربي بشجندي. Imam Hussein approaches Al-Abbas. Al-Abbas hears someone approaching him. He says, Ya hada, billah alayk amhilni ila an yuwaddi'ani akhi. He says, I swear to you by God, give me a few moments. My brother is about to come. Please give me a few moments so that I can say my last farewell to my brother Hussein. Imam Hussein tells him, I'm your brother. Akhi, I'm your brother. He sits next to him. And at that moment, historians say that Imam Hussein put his hand on his back and he said, الآن انكسر ظهري وقلت حيلتي وشمت بي عدوي. خويا خويا انكسر ظهري ولاقدر اقوم. خويا انكسر ظهري ولاقدر اقوم. صرت مركز يا خويا لكل الهموم. يا خويا استوحدوني عقبك القوم ولا واحد علي بعد ينغر. Imam Hussein sits next to him. He puts Abul Fadl al-Abbas's head in his lap. Al-Abbas removes his head. Imam Hussein again grabs his head. He puts it in his lap. Al-Abbas removes his head. The Imam says, Why, my dear brother? For the last moments, I want your head in my lap. He said, No, my brother Hussein. I will not put my head in your lap. Why? He said, Because in an hour from now, you will be on the battleground. In whose lap will you put your head into? خويا ساوي قعبيتي علي يا خويا الساعد ويشمت بي يا ابو فاضل يا خويا قطعت بي. Imam Hussein comes back to the camp. He comes back. His daughter Sakina rushes to him immediately. My dear father, I see you coming alone. You're walking alone. Why isn't Uncle Abbas walking with you? Imam Hussein couldn't say anything. Zainab approaches. My dear brother, where's our brother Al-Abbas? Why are you coming back alone? Why isn't Abbas with you? Imam Hussein couldn't say anything. The only thing he could do is that he came to the tent of Al-Abbas. He came inside, he grabbed the pole and he drops the pole to the ground. The entire tent falling, meaning signaling that the owner of this tent will no longer be needing this tent. He will no longer be coming back.
يقللها يا زينب راح عباس رايح العضيد اللي يرفع الراس.
I want you to take your voice to the haram of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas.
يقللها يا زينب راح عباس راح العضيد اللي يرفع الراس.
لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم. إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون. نسألك اللهم وندعوك باسمك العظيم الأعظم الأعز الأجل الأكرم يا الله. نسألك بباب الحوائج أبي الفضل العباس، اللهم انصر الإسلام والمسلمين، اللهم اخذل الكفار والكافرين، اللهم ادخل على أهل القبور السرور، اللهم اشفي كل مريض، اللهم داوي كل جريح، اللهم لا تدع لنا ذنبا إلا غفرته، ولا همّا إلا فرجته، ولا عيبا إلا سترته، ولا خوفا إلا آمنته، ولا رزقا إلا بسطته، ولا شملا إلا جمعته، ولا مرضا إلا شفيته، ولا غائبا إلا حفظته وأدنيته.
Brothers and sisters, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas has a high level with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let me just tell you this story, just so that you know who's Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. And so that if you have any hajat, you come to Bab al-Hawaj, Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. My older brother, one of my older brothers, went blind. As he was playing with my other brothers, this was about 30 years ago, 35 years ago. They were playing with guns, BB guns. He was shot in his eye, in his left eye, and he went completely blind with one eye. My father took him to a hospital in Kuwait. He went to the hospital. The doctor, he looked at him. He told him that there's no way your son will gain his eye back. No way. Your son is blind. He's completely blind. For a week, my brother remained in the hospital. My mother was in Karbala. My father picked up the phone. He called my mother, and he said, "Our son will not get his eye back. But there's only one way. There's only one way. I want you to run to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas." My mother ran to the haram of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, and she said, "Ya Abu al-Fadl, there's only one thing I want from you. I want the eye of my son." After two months, my brother had his eye completely okay. This is Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas. If you have anything to go to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, go to Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas tonight. Receive whatever you want from Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas ibn Amir al-Mu'minin.